Hello, Freedom Nation. It's Jeff here once again with another episode of the Freedom Nation podcast. And on today's show, I've got Mike Conrad. Mike has a couple of different podcasts, a book, has run a successful business for almost 34 years. So lots to talk about today. We will be discussing entrepreneurship and the challenges that we face as entrepreneurs. For those of you that are sitting out there in your cubicles going, hey, you know, if I only could become an entrepreneur, my life would be so much better. Well, we're going to talk about that and the challenges of that. For those of you that are business owners sitting out there who are going, what did I do? How do I get out of this mess? Well, Mike's going to talk about that as well. So stay tuned. We'll be right back on in just a second.
Welcome to the Freedom Nation Podcast with Jeff Kickle. On this show, Jeff shares his expertise in financial and retirement planning from a different perspective. Planning for your Freedom Day, which is the first day that you wake up and have enough income or assets and do not have to go to work that day. Learn how to calculate what you need, how to generate income sources, and listen to interviews from others who've done it themselves. Get ready to experience your own Freedom Day.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. Mike, how are you, my friend?
I'm well, Jeff. How are you?
I am fantastic. Glad to have you on the show today. I'm really looking forward to doing a little rapping about the world of entrepreneurship and your journey on there. Why don't we kick it off with your story? How did you get to where you're at today?
I lost a bet, Jeff.
Yeah.
It feels that way. Now, I refer to myself frequently as a reluctant entrepreneur. Mm. I was working for, and I'm in the electronic manufacturing space.
Sure.
I've been there for 40 years. And I was working for an equipment manufacturer within that space. And there was some government regulation that was coming down that was going to ban a specific type of chemical that our industry used daily.
Wow.
And it was as impactful on the electronics industry as if the government said, okay, Jeff, in 10 years, we're banning gasoline and all forms of petroleum products, right? The world would come to an end,
yeah.
Right? And that would be terrible. That was our Armageddon in the electronics industry. Mm. This particular chemical was going away. It was relied upon for pretty much every circuit board that was made. And it was going away in 10 years due to an environmental treaty. Mm. And at first, we spent the first few years in the industry, you know, in disbelief, in denial, like, it's too big of a project. There's no alternative. They'll back down at the last minute. And then when we got down to about 3 years left, and no sign of backing down, the industry went into a panic. Mm. So lots of companies tried to come up with an alternate chemical that would work, and no one was really doing it. And I thought of an idea. I said, let's just change the paradigm. Instead of finding a substitute chemical, let's avoid having to have a chemical altogether. Let's do it a different way. And I had this idea in my head, and I pitched it to my boss thinking that, oh my God, Mike, King Mike, you saved the company. They're going to carry me in on a chariot and fan me with grape leaves at my desk and feed me grapes. No, that's not what happened.
not so much.
a little bit shorter. They didn't like the idea in the long run. And I, like a mature 32-year-old, which I was at the time, had a little tantrum, picked up my glove and my ball and went home and said, okay, I'm done. I'm out of here. Complained to my wife about how unfair life was. And she said, well, is it a good idea? And I'm like, I think it's a great idea. She goes, why are you trying to give it away to your employer? Why don't you just do it yourself? Well, Jeff, I had 10 toes hanging over the cliff anyway, and that was just a little nudge, you know, on my back, and that's all I needed. So I didn't quit right away. It took a year, roughly. I converted my garage to a mad scientist studio and started working on proof of concepts and prototypes and all this type of testing, and eventually gave my notice and started my own company doing exactly that. So, reluctant entrepreneur.
Sure.
But my challenge, though, Jeff, was I knew I needed two skill sets to start a to start a company in the electronic space. One was a good technical acumen, which I was fortunate to have. And the other would be a maybe a little bit of a business sense, a little business experience or business training, which I had zero.
Yeah.
But I, the way I looked at it, Jeff, with all of my 32 years of wisdom at the time was, okay, I got the tech stuff down. That's the hardest, right?
Oh, yeah.
How hard can business be, Jeff? Come on. I'm a smart guy. I got all the tech down. I'll figure it out.
There's people without master's degrees that are running businesses. I mean, come on.
Yeah, well, exactly. So I was too stupid to know how stupid I was.
That's okay.
When it came to business, right? Totally so,
sometimes
arrogant.
That's a good thing. So.
Yeah. Well, naivety is, you know, bliss at some point. Yeah. But ignorance is bliss. But I started the business with zero business experience and zero expectations of what business would be like. Hmm. I just thought, well, I'll just, can't be that hard. And it was. And I made about every bonehead mistake any entrepreneur could possibly make. In fact, in my book that I published last year called The Reluctant Entrepreneur, it's not a how-to book, Jeff.
Yeah.
It is a how-not-to book. It is like, don't do this. Instead, do that. So it's got lessons from it. But I made every mistake that, known to mankind in business. Mm-hmm. And the business almost died 1,000 times. In fact, I think technically we were insolvent. I was just too too dumb to know. Yeah. I just kept showing up. I just kept showing up, you know, and we ended up creating this Ponzi scheme, not like in a Bernie Madoff fashion. There were no victims other than ourselves. Yeah. We were both the investors in our Ponzi scheme and the recipients of our Ponzi scheme. We just need more cash. We need more cash. We weren't solvent for a while.
Yeah.
A short while anyway. But we didn't even know it. We just survived on cash flow, mm-hmm. which it turns out, welcome to the world of entrepreneurship.
Yeah,
the many, vast majority many, many business owners
do, yeah.
steal from themselves, right? They, you know, borrow from Peter to pay Paul, and they do it until they get on their feet, and you know, or they get a VC that comes in, and you know, or some type of investor. They do seed rounds, and now they, you know, their company's owned by other people, mm-hmm. you know, at least partially owned by other people, many times controlled by other people. So you know, you pick your poison. But that was my smooth startup into entrepreneurship.
So how many years did it take you to get past the you being the primary seed round for your business? How long did it take you to really get that clicking to where you were starting to feel like, okay, we're at least our heads are above water?
Yeah, I'd say 5 or 6 years of running deficits and then eventually getting into the black and staying there. I mean, the first year was definitely a loss. The second through, say, sixth year was not technically a loss. I say running deficits, meaning that, you know, we worked all year, 365 days pretty much, and didn't really make any money.
Yeah.
We were at zero, you know, maybe we made a few hundred dollars over a year, right? I would have made more money if I had just, you know, turned my couch upside down and shook it and let the change fall out every day for a year, but enough so that we could stay in business. Mm-hmm. And we were working very hard for very little. Mm-hmm. And at some point that, you know, I'm like, okay, you know what? Very few businesses make money their first year, two or three.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I can get that. But 6 years, it's like, okay, I felt like I was still wearing, you know, business diapers. You know, it's like, okay, I got to be potty trained now. I got to actually, the business has to stand on its own and it has to be worth coming in every day.
Sure.
And we ended up making some very radical changes and, you know, which is what every business gets to. They get to this intersection where they either fail.
Yeah.
Or they give up, right? Like, hey, this is too much work, Jeff. I make more money working as a greeter at Walmart, you know, than doing this, which is true for a lot of businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Or you change your game. Mm-hmm. And what I learned is that the traits I brought to the company when I started it at 32 were passion, Okay, that's a positive thing.
That's
a technical expertise. Yeah. That was required. So I got the two. I'm on a roll, Jeff. I'm on a roll. I got two good things. The rest were ego, naivety, arrogance, and a very poor assessment of risk. Hmm. That's what I brought to the table.
Yeah.
Which today I'm grateful for. I couldn't have started the business without naivety and arrogance and ego and poor assessment of risk.
Yeah.
But after a few years, I realized, okay, you know what? These things got my business off the ground. They were able to keep me moving forward because I didn't know any better. They're now going to kill my business. And what I found so typical with entrepreneurs is the skills that get them from A to B fail them from B to C and onward.
Yeah.
It's like getting into a manual transmission car. You start in first gear. You can't go far in first gear, Jeff, right? I mean, you're redlining your RPMs, you know, you're at 6,000 RPM, you're doing 28 miles an hour, and you got to shift to second gear. Mm-hmm. Then you got to shift to third and fourth and fifth and so on.
Yeah.
I was running a car in first gear for too long. And what happens? You blow up your transmission or you over rev your engine and, you know, you know, bust a rod out of cylinder or something. It's not good. So what I had to do was shift from my first gear trait, which I ran too long, into a more appropriate gear. I had to scale myself in order to scale the business.
Okay.
And that involved learning new skills. Mm-hmm. And for that, those skills I couldn't learn or didn't want to learn, I would acquire those new skills through hiring, strategic hiring. And that's what allowed us, after probably year five or six, to really start growing with intention and and being prepared for the next stage of our business, knowing that there's no guarantee that what we did for the first 6 or 7 years would work for the next 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
The rules change and everything changes. So we just started making incremental changes appropriate for what we thought was the, you know, the current scale and model of our business and industry we serve and all that. And it was a stepladder kind of approach, and it worked. And here we are 34 years later, and you know, we're humming along.
Yeah. How many folks do you have working for you?
And we have about 40-ish.
Okay. Nice.
We're a small family run business, and
but it's still a decent sized business. I mean, it's not
We've been bigger. I'm happier where we are. We actually intentionally scaled down a little bit. For a while, one of our mantras was be everything to everybody. And, you know, we do one thing very, very well. And I say that with all sincerity, even though it's my business, there's one thing we do where we are best in class in the world. No one can touch us. Well, no one can touch us. No one has touched us.
Yeah.
That could change by the time I'm off this conversation. But we're really good at one particular thing.
Yeah.
And because of that, we wanted to do other things that were kind of more like also-rans. Mm-hmm. But at some point, we said, okay, stop the madness. Only be good at one thing or only manufacture and sell what we can honestly claim we're best in class. Whether it's 100 things or one thing, doesn't matter. Okay. Only be best in class. And so we started paring down many of our product lines that were also-rans. Mm-hmm. And they were good, but they weren't great. And and we brought it down to a core group of products, which we believe sincerely are best in class. And that means that, you know, we didn't need as many people and we make a whole lot more money off the fewer things that we sell. And our customers are wonderful. They partner with us, really. We have a personal relationship with our customers rather than just a transactional relationship because they know it's best in class. They know that we don't work like many of the other companies in our industry. Mm. Nothing wrong with them, but they're very transactional. We're very relational. And that seems to work for us anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the difference when somebody's comparing you. If there is that relationship that's there, the customer service aspect of it, you know, then you're not working as a commodity, basically, in people's right. minds.
Right. And when you're not a commodity, you don't attract customers who lead with price.
Sure.
Because if 100 people sell it and it's all the same, mm-hmm. you go for the cheapest one. There's very little risk there, right?
Yeah.
We've learned a lot of lessons along our 34 years of mm-hmm. making bonehead decisions and then learning how to make smarter ones.
34 years as a contract electronics manufacturer in the United States and not having to, you know, basically ship all this overseas to bring it back. You know, that says
I refuse to do that.
Yeah.
I refuse to do that. We could make a lot more money, mm-hmm. at least in the short term, if we did that. And
sure.
many companies in our industry have done that. Mm-hmm. And I don't blame them for that. That fit their model. But I just have this belief, you build where you live.
Mm-hmm.
You buy where you live.
You live, yeah.
You hire from where you live.
Mm-hmm.
If we lived in China, we'd be conducting this interview in Mandarin. If I was in India, we'd Bengali, whatever.
Yeah.
But the fact that I'm in the United States, our official purchasing philosophy is buy local.
Mm-hmm.
So our first goal is to when we have to source a part, buy it from California. That's where I live.
Okay.
If you can't get it in California, buy it in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not made in the U.S., and several of our parts, no one in the U.S. makes them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like a computer, for example. There's no computers made here. They might be assembled here. They're not made here. So in that case, we buy it from a U.S. distributor who sources it from wherever they source it from. But we want someone in our own country to mm-hmm. have a little bit of a horse in the race with us.
Yeah.
And that's just a personal belief. Do we spend more money on our machines than we could if we exported everything? Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But this sounds arrogant when I say this, but I do mean it. Money is not an issue with our products.
Mm.
Our customer, and I say that callously, and obviously, to many it is. But what I'm saying is our products solve specific problems.
Okay.
And we don't lead with price. We're not the cheapest. In fact, we're probably on the more expensive side.
Mm-hmm.
But we lead with value. We lead with education. We lead with authority. We lead with all the different benchmarks that typical companies lead with.
Mm.
And our customers form relationships with us. As I said earlier, we're relational, not transactional. And it just works for us. So anyway, very, very long answer to your very short question.
No,
Jeff.
But I think that says a whole lot about your company. You know, when it's not, okay, well, we're just going to do it the cheapest way we possibly can. So, you know, we're going to outsource everything overseas and have it manufactured. And, you know, we're just the pretty front end to that back end. I mean, you know, that says a lot about your company and who you are as a result of that. So, you know, thinking back, what do you think kind of drove you? I mean, you sort of answered this, but what do you think that kept driving you to keep the business running all these years? Because, you know, it's tough. Yes, having 6 years of blanks at the beginning, a lot of people give up, you know, in that what I call year two, year three, the suck. You know, when things just suck really bad, you're not making any money, it's not fun anymore. What kept you going past that?
Jeff, I had two primary motivations.
Okay.
When I started my company, remember I mentioned that I came up with the idea, I pitched it to my boss, and they weren't interested. So I left and started my own company. Well, it turned out after I did that, 6 months into my new company, my boss had a little bit of non-buyer's remorse. He wished he had done it. So he decided to sue me, sue the company and me personally for all these crazy things. And we ended up having a trial. The little bit of startup money I bootstrapped all went away during that whole experience because it all went to the lawyers and it was uber expensive. You know, this was 34 years ago.
Mm.
And, you know, we spent in the low six figures just fighting that lawsuit. That's, we didn't even have six figures. We had mid five figures saved up, and and all of a sudden, you know, added a zero to that. So after we won the lawsuit, I had one main goal, and that was revenge. I was young. I was full of piss and vinegar. I was like, okay, sucker, you're mine now. I wanted nothing but revenge, which meant any order I got at any cost, if I got it away from him, revenge. Mm-hmm. I don't recommend that, although in hindsight, it did keep me going when I should have probably, when a sane person would have given up, right? Mm-hmm. During the suck, as you call it.
Yep.
So revenge was one reason. The other reason was my father and my mother were both immigrants. My father from Poland, my mother from Scotland. There's a fun combination. And and my dad, I used to, when I was young and punky, my dad, I used to refer to my dad as the cheapest man on the planet, because he never made a ton of money, but he was a proud, he was living his American dream. Mm-hmm. He had a house. He went to, when he first immigrated here in 1957, he went to college by day, worked by night, and, you know, made something of himself and had a decent job. And, but he was frugal beyond belief. Yeah. And I was too young and cocky to see why, where he came from and what he's doing. But I learned to appreciate it later. But at some point when I started my business, I think, okay, I'm going to need a business loan. So I went to a bookstore, couldn't really afford the book. So I sat on the floor of the bookstore and tried to memorize as much, you know, how to write a business plan as I could. Went back, wrote up a business plan, put it in a $1 Staples binder, took it to a bank. And of course they turned me down, as did three other banks. So I finally went to my dad and gave him a pitch, knowing he'd say no, because he's the cheapest man on the planet. And he said yes. And he loaned me $70,000.
Wow.
To start the business. He actually had to mortgage his house.
Oh, geez.
To a home equity loan on his house to give me that money.
But let's add another layer of stress onto you at the beginning.
Absolutely. So now you're seeing the picture between revenge and I cannot stiff my dad.
Yeah.
I would feel bad if I stiffed the bank. Mm. I would be devastated if I stiffed my father.
Yeah.
And my father was also a very tough father. He had this strange version of tough love. And one of his one of his normal practices was very, very sparing on compliments.
Okay.
Because if they come too easy, they're worth nothing. Mm. So I was always seeking a compliment. I was always seeking his attention, his approval, his adoration. And I was rarely getting it. So I needed to be successful because I needed that. Just, you know, stupid parent stuff in your head. And he borrowed money against his house. I'm not going to be that guy. Nope. And I don't want my former boss to see me fail. That's the reason I stuck with it.
Like double whammy on top of you at that point.
Not going to fail, Jeff. I'm not going to fail. Even if I'm faking the success for a while, I'm going to fake it till I make it. And, you know, I think that, like, the failure is not an option, you know, Apollo 13 kind of mentality.
Yep.
That's what gets people out of the suck.
Yeah.
And they start doing things right. They start experiencing a whole different mindset, which brings on a whole different set of circumstances in the business that are much more positive. And we all need that hook to that. Just, no, you cannot, out of this.
Yeah. I would never take the leap because I had a great job and I wasn't taking the leap until I finally reached a point where I was working for a company I just couldn't stand working for anymore. And, you know, for me, it was, I would sooner live in a car than go back to work for them at that point. So, you know, it's kind of the same cocky thing just later in life, but same thing. It was like, okay, and then it became for me, okay, I can't let this fail because so many people are relying on me at that point. I just couldn't let it fail. I was going to figure out a way to make it work.
Yeah. We all have our strange motivations, and
that's okay.
I'm convinced that, you know, in the psychology world, there's the DSM, which is Diagnostic something something. It's where every psychological ailment mm-hmm. is listed in this book. I think entrepreneurs are in there somewhere. we have our own section
our own
of the spectrum.
Just on
we
that.
We are our own yeah. chapter. Exactly. Exactly. Because we are, we think differently and we can never, another reason I could never fail is because I'm unhirable today.
That's
probably you are too. Once
exactly
you get a taste of entrepreneurship and you're doing it yourself, you are now officially the world's worst employee because A, you don't follow rules, you draw outside the lines, you certainly don't do stupid. Mm-hmm. And PC is out the window. You are a bull in a china shop at that point. Unhirable.
That is, as my
fail.
My friend puts it, she says she's genetically unemployable.
So. Yes. that's a good way to put it. Yeah. I like that.
That is awesome. Well, what's new in your world that you might want to share with the audience?
Well, I live in a very interesting world. My professional life, you know, we're in the electronics industry. And let me tell you, we've been talking now for about 27 minutes, 28 minutes, and probably 100 things have changed in our industry in that 28 minutes. It is evolving at the speed of light, man. It's crazy. So in my professional world, I'm not a surfer. I live in California, but I'm not a surfer. But I don't know what the term is, hang 10 or something, but when the board is just in front of the wave, not behind it, not over the trough, but you're just in front of the wave, that's where my business needs to stay. Because if we slow down for a second and stop evolving and stop evolutionizing, the wave just will bury us and we'll be, you know, it'll be impossible to catch up, right? Mm-hmm. We have to wait for the next wave to come and hope we don't get behind that. So even though I still own my business, I don't work in it anymore. Mm-hmm. I stopped working in it a while ago, and my staff pays me to stay away, which has a great ROI, by the way, for a lot of reasons. But I still own it, but I'm no longer day-to-day stuff. My team runs the company way, way better than I did. And one of my jobs, one of my responsibilities is to learn what's the next wave or where are we on that wave? Yeah. Are we on the crest of it are we getting behind it? Are we staying too far in front? I do an awful lot of public speaking. I'm a road warrior. I'm speaking at technical conferences all around the world. And so I get to hear what all the other speakers are talking about. So I've got I got my ear on the tracks in terms of knowing where we are technologically in our industry, what new trends are, which ones are hype, which ones are, you know, have got some traction. And as they concern our specific space in our industry, what we need to do to prepare for that. Mm. And so I'll never be out of a job. If that's what I love doing, which I do, I'll never be out of that job because there's only the only thing guaranteed is that change will always come, right? Mm. It will never stop in my industry. So that keeps me pretty busy. And, you know, my job now as the owner of the company is to create the content and provide the education and liaison with the industry, serve the industry and my company, and most importantly, sit on the crow's nest way up high and with my binoculars and look as far out onto the horizon as I can to help guide the company, just like one would guide a ship, and kind of be the navigator, not the engineer, not the quartermaster, not the people in the engine room, but not even the captain, but beyond that, like the admiral. that would be the equivalent of what I do now.
That's awesome. And it's where we should all be. I mean, at this point in your life, that's where it's your zone of genius to be in that spot. And, you know, it's the important thing is to find our zone of genius and make sure we stay there and not bounce around and try to go to other areas. So,
right.
Awesome.
Agreed.
Well, let's transition to the fast five questions now. All right, you ready?
All set.
All right. First question. You wake up in the morning, business is gone. You have $500, a laptop computer, place to live, food and clothing. What are you going to do first?
First thing I'll do with my $500 is go to a bar, spend 20 on a couple of cocktails and figure out what happened.
Yeah.
I don't think at 65 years old, I would have a desire to rebuild the company or a company. Yeah. I think I would continue to, with my single laptop and my $480 now after a couple of drinks in my pocket, I'll just continue what I do now, which is education. And, you know, I've already had my degree of success with the company, building the company. I think I would just continue to share my experiences with other entrepreneurs so that maybe they could maybe skip a few steps and not make the same mistakes I made, maybe learn from my mistakes and others, and get to wherever I got a little bit sooner. I think that's what I would do. So my day wouldn't change a whole lot.
Yeah. Yeah. You're already doing that today. Just keep doing what you're doing. And, you know, I think it probably would be even easier because you have not have the company on your back to worry about. You can just focus on doing what you do best.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love it.
That's probably what I do.
What's your biggest business mistake?
Oh my God, do you have 10 hours?
you just have to
this
pick
is
one.
First of 10 long. Episodes. Yes, this is a miniseries here. There's so many, but I would say that the way we used to advertise, the way we used to market, we were very obnoxious. We were arrogant, boastful. You know, our ads would say almost verbatim, you know, we're the best, everyone else sucks. We let on price. We lost no order. Even if we lost money on the order, we would get that order. And, you know, that's part of the revenge thing, I think.
Yeah.
And one year we went to a trade show and we had this $70,000 waterfall that we rented. And it was just absolutely spectacular.
Yeah.
And someone wanted to take a picture of it. And we said, sure, yeah, you can take a picture of it. And then he asked if we could move our equipment out of the way so he can get a better shot of the waterfall. And that was a 2x4 in the face, Jeff. I'm like, what the hell are we doing? We don't sell waterfalls, Jeff. We sell this equipment. And well, what do you mean move the equipment out of the way?
Out of the way, that's the whole point.
Exactly. Thank you. But that's when it hit me. That was the business gods.
Yeah.
Just saying, okay, someone hit him over the head with a mallet. I mean, he's just not
getting this. Yeah, you're not getting this.
Yeah, so I got it. That was a well-delivered message, and that was the last time for years that we exhibited in a trade show.
Okay.
We stopped running ads. We canceled all our ad contracts for the rest of the year and switched to something that I like to call conscious marketing, where we basically, what I've learned basically is if you want to sell your product, stop talking about your product.
Mm.
No one cares. We were throwing around specs that no one even understood. We thought they were great. They just went, oh, is that good? So we started education. We started producing workshops and webinars and podcasts and books and lecture series. And I started speaking all over the world and writing technical papers. And now we sell through education. We sell through building authority. We sell through becoming an authority-based influencer in our space.
Sure.
And that's worked very well for us.
Awesome. I love that. What's a good book that you'd recommend for our audience?
That's easy. Jim Collins, Good to Great.
It's a great book.
great book. And due to time, I won't get into it, but great book. Trust me. Trust Jeff. I've learned so many things from that book that really helped me. It was the beginning of the metamorphosis of my company, reading that book.
Okay. Nice. Well, that's one of the ones on the shelf behind me. Those are the most important books of my life. And it's one that I've gone back to multiple times. And it's just, you know, you just go back and, oh, man, I needed that. Yeah, that was what I needed right now. I don't remember reading that the first time. Now it fits into something I'm doing. Yeah.
And as a bonus, his other book, Jim Collins' other book, Built to Last, is also worth reading.
Yeah.
But, Good to Great was perfect for me when the business was struggling and I didn't know why. I could identify with everything he said in that book.
Absolutely. What's a tool that you use in your business every day that you might recommend?
I'll give you a couple answers. I'm not so much in my business anymore, so yeah. I'm going to answer it. I'll give you one answer, but I'll answer it this way. I use AI all the time. My AI of choice is ChatGPT, the paid version, and I use it to research stuff. So, you know, the old way was you went on Google. Well, the old way is you went to the library, okay?
Sure.
The modern old way is you went on Google, and then it just gave you links to 40 different websites, and you had to go to those websites and vet that information. AI now, which has built-in web search, which it didn't originally, will just go out and look at 40 different websites and summarize it for you. You still have to check. It's still not perfect. It still hallucinates. There's all sorts of issues with it, but it really, it's a giant fishing net to give you everything that you want in one deliverable, comprehensible report. And I use that regularly to do research on my for my podcast, to research my guests, to research subjects that I'm speaking about, writing about. And I use that regularly. I also, I serve on the board of directors of a few different things unrelated to my industry. And I also used it, I threw in basically the entire financial statement because I had some concerns over some stuff that was going on with that particular organization.
Yeah.
And man, I felt like I just hired a CFO that just showed up and gave me some answers right away. It spotted trends and things that I didn't see. And I went from being terrible at financial statements to pretty good at it. And I didn't see that. And it spotted some stuff that looks like it has some tractions. But so I like AI. I think it has to be used with caution. But I think it there's so much. If I were to build my company over again today, I think I could have developed technically faster using that tool than I did.
Well, I mean,
just because it, you know, the resources weren't all there.
It basically takes the place of that consultant you might hire. I mean, that's the way I've used it, you know, in the past is, you know, I've used it to say, hey, I want to take my business down this pathway. What's the best way to do it? And then start to have kind of a back and forth conversation on that. I don't know if you've, I don't know if you've tried it, but have you used Claude lately?
No, I've played with some of the others. But I hear, you know, it's funny, those AI is a kind of thing where the first one you use, you tend to like stick to.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I'm just so impressed with AI in general.
Yep.
I think it's one of the few times we are aware that we are watching history being made.
Yeah.
Right. Usually we don't appreciate technical evolution until it becomes status quo.
Sure.
And then you remember what life was like without it. And you go, oh my God, wow, that was really impactful. You know, computers, for example, or the internet, for example. Yep. This is one of those things.
It's
happening at a pace faster than any other evolutionary or even revolutionary thing. I mean, you look at electricity. When electricity was discovered, I hate when people say invented. It's like, oh, really? God goes, yeah, you invented that? Really? but when it was discovered and eventually through Edison and Nikola Tesla and all that, you know, who's going to win the war over what kind of AC or DC is in the house? Once cities adopted a particular strategy for electrifying homes and buildings and entire cities, it still took 30 years for it to spread across the country, right?
Yeah.
And or more. When steam trains came out, it took decades for people to actually start utilizing them. When AI came out, it took minutes for people to start finding uses for it. I mean, it's crazy.
I mean, you
speed.
Look at, you look at 3 years later, I mean, just remembering what it was like 3 years ago versus what it does today, it's off the charts.
It'll probably be different when we go back to it. And, you know, when we're done talking here, it'll have changed. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, it was funny because I typically used Claude to do a lot of writing and things like that. It was very helpful from that perspective. But I was just happened to be on there the other day, and I said, you know what? I'm trying to kind of tweak a new YouTube channel, and I found kind of a prototype for what I wanted. And I was like, you know, hey, can you just give me an idea, like 30 days worth of content based on what has worked on this one guy's channel? And what came out was the most beautiful piece of information I've ever seen in my life. The most well-researched, hands-down best piece of information that I've ever seen. And I'm thinking to myself, I could have spent months in the past trying to watch videos and try and figure out what was working and what wasn't. And, you know, having something that you can move that fast on and be able to really hit the ground running, you know, like I said, I mean, it, whatever your drug of choice is, pick it, use it, and run like crazy with it. So,
yeah, I totally agree. Yeah.
Last question for you. What is your definition of freedom?
You know, that's a good question. It's contextual, obviously. Yeah. So today I'll say it's the ability to build or speak or contribute without having to ask permission.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from an experience I had when I was younger in my industry, where I suffered some pretty severe imposter syndrome. And I was asked to speak at a conference. I was not good at public speaking. As ironically, it's what I do for a living now. But but I was afraid to be me. I was afraid that I didn't deserve to be there, which I didn't. I was a college dropout in a world of highly educated people. And I just felt like I was an imposter. And now, I mean, I don't feel that way. And even if I did go into some conversation or field that I'm not familiar with, I feel like I could be authentic in my ignorance or authentic in my expertise, whatever applies. And I have the freedom to do that.
Yeah.
There's so many contexts of how to define freedom. There's financial freedom. There's time freedom. There's all sorts of, you know, there's medical, you know, health freedom. But in the context of what I've changed most personally about me, from being rather introverted to, oh my God, Mike, shut up, quit talking, let someone else get a word in edgewise, which is the current Mike. And, you know, Mike that's known to give relatively outrageous presentations in a very stuffy world of electronics manufacturing technical conferences. You can get how that can be PhD'd to death. It, to me, that just opened up my world in such a way where I'm unabashed. I'm not ashamed. I'm not afraid to look stupid. I own who I am, for better or for worse, right?
Yep.
And I just don't care anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that authentic me.
Yeah, that authenticity is what people, what attracts people to a good speaker, is being authentic.
Ironically, although I was afraid if I was authentic, no one would like what I was saying. So I was inauthentic and not a very good speaker. And when I just dropped all the pretense, people see that.
Yep.
Even if they don't agree with you, they see the authenticity and they know it's real. Mm-hmm. And they appreciate the, you know, the taking the mask off and just being you. Mm-hmm. And it turns out you are not that bad. I'm not that bad.
Yeah.
So it all lived up here. You know, it was all mental. So that is overall, I think, my greatest sense of freedom, the freedom to just be authentic, to be me, to speak, to build, to create without having to get permission or acceptance. Just do it. Like Nike, just do it.
Love it, love it, love it. Well, if somebody's interested in learning a little bit more about you and what you're doing, where you're speaking, where's the best place to go?
Well, two things. They can follow me on LinkedIn. Just type in, you know, Mike Conrad, Conrad with a K. I think technically the handle is M.T. Conrad with a K. Also, MikeConrad.com. Is a good, it's my personal website, but it's a portal. It takes you to my entrepreneurial work. It takes you to my technical work, my professional work. It's kind of a good hub to get you to where else I am. So MikeConrad.com or follow me on LinkedIn or both.
Love it. Or both. Try both. Well, folks, we'll put that in the show notes page. Mike, thanks for being on the show. Really appreciated you sharing your expertise and your journey with us. So, it's just great to hear that you've been so successful at this, but, it didn't just come naturally overall. So thank you for being on the show today.
Well, thanks for being a great host, asking wonderful questions. I really appreciate the effort you put in as well. So good talking to you, Jeff.
You as well. Well, folks, make sure that you subscribe to the channel. Make sure you check out the show notes and go to Mike's different channels and all that. Listen to his podcasts where you can learn a little bit more. And we will see you guys back here the very next time.
Thank you for listening to the Freedom Nation podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and all the major channels. Wherever you're listening, please subscribe to the channel and leave a rating and review. If you have friends and family that could benefit from their own Freedom Day, please share with them. Finally, join Freedom Nation by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.